Tell me that.
Health and Human Services Committee will come to order. Today is April 28th. We have before us a bill by Senator Hand. Senator Hand, which bill number are you taking up first?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. We'd like to take up Senate File 1101, My Life, My Choices.
Senate File 1101. Senator Hand moves Senate File 1101. Senator Hand, do you want to speak to that, or do you have testifiers?
Mr. Chairman and members, this is part of a group of three separate but related bills that were brought to the legislature by Lutheran Social Services. They are, important. I've described them in another committee as kind of like creating almost a charter school-like approach to dealing with issues of how we manage disabilities and people with disabilities and the care that that we provide. And this is the creation of a task force, and I would like to invite, I believe there are some representatives from Lutheran Social Services who are here. Yes. And I'd like to ask them to speak to the, maybe how the idea was generated and just some of the details of the bill.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. I'm Jody Harpstead, the Chief Operating Officer at Lutheran Social Service. Well, we are relearning the old adage this year that necessity is the mother of invention. Facing into this difficult biennium budget has been a challenge. On the other hand, it has given us the opportunity to imagine a whole new world for people with developmental disabilities in the state of Minnesota, and it's been a great adventure. Working with the Public Strategies Group, we've put together this design that we call My Life, My Choices. And some of the highlights of the elements of that design include putting together the many pots of money that come into the state of Minnesota to serve people with developmental disabilities into a single budget that someone with disabilities can see everything that is allocated to them. And then having that person and a trusted partner be able to go out into the marketplace and use that budget with the support of a fiscal support entity to purchase services. Another element of the whole idea is that we're looking, instead of designing a system that causes as little risk as possible for people, that we design a system that allows for as much independence as possible for people so they can live full human lives as participants and contributors to the community. You can imagine that with a system that's been put into place over many decades, it's not easy to put together a single bill that changes all of that in one session. So there are a lot of fabulous improvements to the system that are in bill language that's been introduced otherwise. But we also wanted to introduce this bill that creates a task force that continues to exist after this session and continues to iron out the kinks and to propose additional legislation in the next legislative session. There are some things we run into as we're talking with folks in the community and at the Department of Human Services that we find are just more time-consuming to work out than we can do in this one session. We also find that because we're talking about a Medicaid waiver population, that there are a lot of federal regulations that we bump into and we'll need to deal with. And so our proposal is for a task force that continues to serve after the session and includes many different members from the community, the legislature, the business community, the providers, people with disabilities and their families, and advocates to continue ironing out these kinds of issues and bringing this forward further. It would be our dream that in a couple, 3 years, we do have a world called My Life, My Choices, and all the elements are put together, but that would be the charge of the task force to keep moving in that direction.
Thank you. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I would like to offer as an author's amendment the A1 amendment. I believe council has copies of that amendment. And members, this is more of a technical amendment, but it does conform to, I believe, the language that was adopted in the other body, and what we're hoping is that we can avoid having to go to a conference. I think the changes are not substantive. It changes a word on line 11, page 1, from partner to advocate, and then inserts some language with respect to the appointment and operation of the task force itself, on page 1, line 24, and also on page 2, line 14. There's some language additions, changes.
Senator Hahn offers the A1 amendment, and we do have that in our packets, correct? Are there any questions? Seeing none, Senator Hahn offers the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. We now have Senate File 1101 as amended before us.
And, Mr. Chairman, I just want to make it clear that even though it appears that we have no one in the committee, we do have a quorum.
Oh, yes. I've not announced a quorum, and we did wait to start until we had a quorum. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr.
That's
Chairman.
Why you're the chair, and I'm the fill-in here.
All right. Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions, or our witness would, if there are any from members of the committee. I don't believe that this is controversial. We think it's an important part of the effort to bring about some change, and we hope reform and improve what we do. But if there are any questions, be happy to try to respond.
I don't see any questions from the committee. Are there any members in the audience that are wanting to testify on this bill? Don't see anybody. So, Senator Hahn, do you want to move the bill as amended?
Is yes.
To go to the floor?
Well, Mr. Chairman, my understanding is it has to go to government operations or state government, whatever the name of the committee is. Maybe our staff can, because we're creating a task force, I think it has to go to another committee. I just want to make sure I have that committee name correct.
Operations and Innovation.
It would be State Government Operations and Innovation.
So, Senator Hahn moves that Senate File 1101 as amended.
He recommended to pass and sent to state government.
Innovation. And veterans, I guess.
And veterans.
Name. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails. The bill is, as amended, is passed and sent. Senator Hahn, you have another bill, Senate File 1284.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this is the Department of Human Services policy bill, and I would like to invite the department to come forward and join me, and I'm going to rely on them to present the bill. This was something that was brought to us not long ago. I think we actually got the jacketed bills on the 15th, and I will be frank with the committee. There are some questions that I have about the bill. I'm going to ask that the department would sort of walk us through the bill. There may be some amendments that we would want to incorporate. However, there is one. There are two that I think amendments that are technical in nature that were brought by counsel that I'd like to offer, at least initially, as author's amendment. So let's first take up the A1 amendment, which I understand from counsel is just some technical language. Is that correct?
Yes. Senator Hahn has moved Senate File 1284 and now is offering what we have before us, the A4 amendment.
I'm sorry, the A1 amendment.
I'm sorry. You're offering the A1, so that must be in the packets. The A4 was handed to me, so I'm sorry. The A1 amendment, yes, which is a lot more technical and longer. All right. Is there any discussion on the A1 amendments? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
And, Mr. Chairman and members, I'd also like to offer at this time the A4 amendment, which I believe also is more of a technical amendment that was brought, I believe, by the department. I think it is clarifying language.
Senator Hahn,
I believe you have copies of that.
Yes, that was handed out. Senator Hahn has moved the A4 amendment. Are there any questions from the committee? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. We now have the bill as amended before us. Senator Hahn?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. As I said, I would like to ask the department to take us through the bill article by article, and I would like to, because I'm a little concerned about the exposure this bill has had, and I'm not sure that there has been sufficient opportunity for people who may be affected by contents of this bill to have had an opportunity to review it. And, Mr. Chairman, I would just like to suggest that if there are portions of the bill, there may be people in the audience that would want to comment, and I would certainly be willing to entertain those comments. And so perhaps we could take this article by article and see if there are questions with respect to the article as we deal with them, and then after we've addressed that, move on to the next article.
Certainly. Well, Senator Hand, I see you have someone from the department here. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Shannon Kojasoy for the Department of Human Services. And I'll just start and speak briefly on each section, but please stop if you have any questions. The first article is a rehabilitation technical. This just clarifies that language that passed in 2010 does not apply to managed care organizations. These organizations are authorized rehabilitative services under a different methodology. Article 2 aligns our personal care appeals process under managed care with the fee-for-service appeals process. So it just clarifies when a recipient may request to continue those services. Article.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hand, yes.
I'm just wondering if you could, at the conclusion of the presentation, just ask the audience here if anybody from the audience wants to comment on the article.
Sure, article by article, absolutely. Article 1, is there anyone that wants to address Article 1 questions or comments? All right, well then let's move on to Article 2. And at the end of that one, if you will pause, we'll ask the same question.
And Mr. Chair, members, Article 2 is just the clarification on the personal care services.
And the same question, anyone want to address this or any questions? All right, Sina, please proceed.
Article 3 is the federal poverty guideline. And so this clarifies a reference that was passed in 2009, where it clarified that federal poverty guidelines, which are linked with the consumer price index, will not go below the year prior. At that time, we said they would not go below 2009 levels. And that is in statute. This year, we'd like to just clarify that to say the federal poverty guidelines will not go below the year prior.
Senator Hand.
And Mr. Chairman, I thank you. And I do want to just ask for some clarification from the department. If could you tell us a little bit about the financial effect of this change? What does this do, for example, with respect to affecting eligibility, or what is the likely effect that this might have on the budget?
Ms. Kursoy.
Mr. Chair, members, this will likely have no effect on the budget. It's more just comfort language. In 2009, the consumer price index did go in reverse for the first time, and there was some concern that the federal government would then lower the federal poverty guidelines in accordingly. The concern was then there would be very few people removed from the programs as a result of the lowering federal poverty guidelines, but potentially a large systems impact to the department in order to correct for that new guideline. And so at that time, this was put in because we were not sure what the federal government would do.
And Ms. Kojasoy, that makes sense to me, and it certainly would not have an impact on the budget because the budget is what the budget is. But what if we were, and we've not seen this in any of our lifetimes, but what if we were to enter into a pretty significant deflationary environment? Has that been discussed at the department?
Mr. Chair, members, and I may ask my colleague to come up and share a little more information on this to see if that has been reviewed.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
My name is Kim Carlin. I work for the Department of Human Services. When this bill passed in 2009, we did have discussions with reports and forecasts. Their opinion at that time was that there would be so few people impacted that there would not be an impact to the budget. It may be important to remember that if people go below the poverty guidelines, they still have an opportunity to be eligible through the medically needy group. And so to the extent they have medical bills, they still would be eligible for medical assistance. In terms of your question about future inflation, I wouldn't be able to respond to that. We didn't have specific conversations. I didn't. I'm assuming the people who calculate those impacts may have taken that into account.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. My question just it's not a significant concern of mine, but it with this language, if we were to enter into a significant deflationary environment, obviously the legislature meets every year, and we could address that after no more than a year, theoretically anyway, but the law would prevent us from making significant downward adjustments, even if that really were merited. Just an observation on my part more than anything. Any questions or comments from members or in the audience? Ms. Cortesoy? Okay.
Mr. Chair, members, Article 4. This article clarifies and better places language in response to the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. It repeals the general language regarding compliance with federal law relating to the American Indian language and places it in more appropriate places in statute.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, has this area been paid for? The cost of this covered, or are they? I know there's a request for federal compliance, but.
Ms. Cortesoy.
Mr. Chair, members, the fiscal impacts of this was considered when the general statutory language was implemented.
Chairman, so maybe I'll ask my question in a more clear fashion. When was it paid for?
Ms. Cortesoy.
Mr. Chair, members, I will ask my colleague Kim again to come up to maybe speak to that in more detail.
Thank you, Ms. Karna.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, when this bill, or when the federal government passed this law in 2009, it was late in the session. We did not know what the impacts of this bill would be at that of the federal law at that time. It was brought forward as a compliance issue, and there were no costs factored in at that time. I can tell you since implementation, there are approximately 800 households in Minnesota Care with whose premiums are exempt, and 35 individuals in the MAEPD program with premiums exempt. It's a rather small amount of money, I believe. It looks like it's around $45,000 a month at this point in time. And in terms of the asset protections, the assets that are protected under the federal law are, we haven't found any assets that aren't protected under some other provision of the law that's already in existence. So there's no impact to those provisions.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, that was nice information. I appreciate it, but it still didn't answer my question. So this $45,000 a month cost has been paid for where and when?
Ms. Carr?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, again, there were no costs booked in the 2009 session when this passed, so I believe it's reflected in the forecast at this point.
Follow-up, Senator Berglund?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. And so the forecast hasn't been paid for, has it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, I don't know the answer to that. I don't know. Is there someone here, Sharon?
Mr. Chairman, it would
Senator
be my
Berglund.
Assumption that it would be in the forecast for this year. And my assumption is, since we don't have a balanced budget yet, it hasn't been paid for.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, my understanding, my recollection from speaking with Mr. Hoffman was that there were very few people impacted by this. We can take this question back and ask him about that, get a better explanation for you.
Senator Berglund, is that adequate for now?
I guess we'll have to stay tuned.
Okay, that was Article 4. Are there any questions or comments from anyone in the room? All right. Ms. Cortesoy, you want to proceed?
Mr. Chair, members, Article 5. This article just provides definition and clarification on pharmaceutical ingredients and excipients. And it clarifies that the circumstances under which those are paid for by the state of Minnesota.
Any questions or comments I don't see any. Proceed.
Article 6, this is minimum quantity of over-the-counter drugs. And this just modifies the requirements for dispensing over-the-counter drugs and allows a bit more flexibility in dispensing those drugs.
We'll ask the same question. Questions or comments from those in attendance here? No, not seeing any. All right. Please proceed.
Article 7, this clarifies the intent and process for the emergency claim submission. 2010 language referenced just the Medicare criteria. That criteria will not be required until approximately 2014. And so at this time, we've clarified that language in statute.
Okay.
And removed the reference to Medicare.
Any questions or comments from those in attendance? No one's jumping up, so we can move on.
Article 8, this article clarifies the age of children seeking hospice services. We just received clarifying language following the 2010 session, and the definition of child seeking hospice services has been changed from 21 to 20. No children are receiving those services between the ages of 21 and 20 currently, so there is no impact.
Anyone wish to speak to this? All right, proceed.
Article 9, this article just defines services that are considered investigative and clarifies that Minnesota Healthcare Programs does not cover investigative services.
Any comment or question from those in attendance on this section? All right, then we will proceed on to the next.
Okay. Article 10.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hand.
Just before we proceed on Article 9, the language in Article 9, and could you talk a little bit about what is this? What is this reflecting? Is this something that this is new language? Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hand, yes. The intention of this is to just clarify our process in statute, but this is in accordance with current process, so it should not change current process, but will assist our staff. In the appeals process to have something and assist others to have something to reference that clearly states what is considered investigative and what we cover at the department.
Okay. Unless there's further question, then we'll move on to the next section.
Article 10 is clarification of the definition of durable medical equipment and requires vendors of durable medical equipment to enroll as Medicare providers.
Ms. Corso, did we not have definition? There's a lot of new language here. Did we not have definition previously?
Mr. Chair, members, we did have this defined in rule and, again, wanted to clarify it and place it in statute for more transparency.
Any questions or comments? All right, then proceed.
Article 11 seeks to remove obsolete language that refers to the payment delay that was authorized in 2004 to phase in the coverage of the elderly waiver services under managed care payments.
Not seeing anyone jumping up to talk to this. We'll keep moving.
Article 12 seeks to clarify authority to contract with managed care plans, including sponsors of Medicare special needs plans and current Medicaid health plans, including those who formerly sponsored Medicare special needs plans.
Okay. I don't see any questions on this. Then we'll move on to the next article.
Article 14. This article clarifies the criteria for designation as a community clinic, and in particular is clarifying that those clinics cannot limit their percentage of their patients to Rule 101.
And Ms. Cortesa, I think we skipped over Article 13.
Oh, I apologize. Mr. Chair, members, Article 13 just codifies the current name of the Health Service Advisory Council in statute. There's two names that have been used, so it just clarifies that is the one name.
That was so complicated. I wanted to make sure that we got to that.
Yes, thank you.
Any questions or comments on those two articles? Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I have some concern about the language on page 22. Relating to the community clinics. I don't believe the explanation that you gave is really clear in the language in this on this page. And I am concerned because community clinics serve a lot of uninsured people. And it could be interpreted that our state health care program patients could take priority and edge out an uninsured patient. And, you know, we want our community clinics to serve uninsured people. And so I would ask that the department do some work on this language to clarify it. I don't have an amendment ready today, but.
Senator Berglund, are you referring to the new language on lines 20 on page 22? Is that what you're?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Ms. Cortesoy?
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, that was not the intention of this proposal, and we will definitely work with you to amend that language so it better fits the intention.
I appreciate that.
Senator Higgins, was your question similar?
Whatever it was, I've forgotten it. So go right ahead.
Okay. Any questions or comments from members in attendance here in the audience? I'm not seeing any. We will move on to the next article, I believe 15.
Article 15, this proposal would allow federal financial participation on Minnesota Care Program payments. At the end of 2010 legislative session, the final budget included this but did not include the statutory language necessary to implement this.
Okay, and I see someone jumping up here. Please have a seat at the table. State your name for the record.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. And first of all, I want to apologize for doing this at the last minute. I'm hoping that this is a technical issue. We don't have the amendment drafted today. I just want to go on the record and say this might be some language that we would like to insert here if Senator Hand would be so willing to do as this bill moves through the legislative process. You all may recall the infamous quarterly DSH payments that hospitals received a number of years ago. These were add-on payments that every hospital in the state of Minnesota received. When we were looking for funding sources for the new GAMC program, we eliminated the quarterly DSH payments that all hospitals received as a way to pay for the GAMC program. What has happened now is that CMS has said all hospitals no longer have to do a DSH audit unless they receive DSH payments. So there are about 50 hospitals that are having to go through this paperwork of accepting DSH payments, even though they will never qualify for receiving a DSH payment. So Richard Tester at the Department of Human Services said that this is a burden on the 50-some hospitals are having to do these DSH reports even though they no longer get DSH money, and that this would be a vehicle for doing that technical change. We are not pushing this if the department says it is a burden, but it is an opportunity to change that reporting burden for 50 hospitals if Senator Hand and the committee would be willing to work on that with the department.
Any comments, Senator Hand?
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Krinke, yes, I'd be happy to work with you on. I'm not sure what the position of the department is, but I think that this bill, do we have to send it to another committee after this? So I guess it may end up in a conference, and so there would be an opportunity to do some changes there if we need to, or possibly when it gets to the floor. But maybe the representative department could respond as well.
Mr. Chair and members, yes, I think that we've briefly reviewed that amendment, and we do believe at this point that is fine. We'd like to discuss it a little further and then hopefully work with Catherine to amend that in the conference committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Hand.
Thank you. Anyone else wanting to speak to this section? This article, I'm sorry. Article 16, Ms. Cortesoy.
Article 16, this article has multiple provisions, and I will just briefly walk through each of those sections. Let's Part of this proposal, termination of terminated providers. This proposal requires DHS to terminate providers that have been terminated from Medicare or other state health care programs. Another section requires the national provider identifier on all claims for services. Another part of this proposal will allow DHS to revoke enrollment for 1 year per incident if a physician or supplier fail to maintain and provide access to documentation related to written orders or requests.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, could you tell us where you are? You're saying there's a provision here and a provision there. Could you tell us the section or the page and lines so that we can follow along, please?
Ms. Cortesan.
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, I apologize. Yes, I will walk through. Mine are a little, they're not as following this, so I will clarify that with the language. This is Article 16, so it's page 26. Yeah. And the language, much of it is separate. There is some language that is combined in Section 4 that represents multiple provisions. And these are all changes required by federal law or encouraged by federal law. And they all apply to fraud and abuse and waste. So that first section I reference is just definition of termination. The second section is prohibition on payments to providers outside of the United States. This is current practice. Section 3 is the requirement that the national provider identifier is listed on claims. Section 4 allows the department the authority to place a temporary moratorium on those providers that have been deemed high risk or of high abuse. Move forward the language within that section, Section C, D, and E, again, goes to the authority to allow to terminate or withhold payments from providers. And also within that section, there's language that expands DHS authority to subject individuals or entities making false statements to permissive exclusions and civil monetary payments at penalties. At this time, we only have the authority to terminate those providers, so this allows us a little more of a nuanced authority for certain punishments, certain abuses. And that is also in Section 7. And also within that language, it requires providers to disclose current or previous affiliation with providers that have uncollected debt, suspended payments, or exclusion from federal programs. This will allow us to collect or exclude providers who have had fraudulent behavior under one identification number and then just created another providing service under another name that may be affiliated with them. And I believe that offers a brief summary of that section. Please let me know if you have any questions.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, on page 27, line 4-ish, there's a provision that says that the commissioner has to announce a temporary moratorium of enrolling any new providers in the state register. And I think, if I remember correctly, this is kind of the paper of record for stuff we do. But I'm really curious about how many providers actually check out the state register on a regular basis and would actually find out about it. And I'm wondering whether maybe an addition to this might be, you know, the department has to send notice by email to all the providers they have email for, or, you know, something in this century, maybe.
Ms. Cortesan, do you want to address that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, I believe this is also posted on the website, but I will request my colleague to come up and also maybe share a little more background on that.
So, Mr. Chair, it doesn't say
Senator Higgins
that it's posted on the website anywhere I can see?
Senator Higgins, you're correct. I don't see the language in the bill. I believe the indication is that that's current practice, but it would not be required by statute as per this language right now. Ms. Cortez?
Mr. Chair, members, we are definitely open to working with you to make the language more comfortable and state that clearly if you would like.
So, Mr. Chair,
Senator Higgins.
Ms. Cotasoy, if putting it on the website is current practice, but it isn't in statute anywhere, you could just go ahead and find other ways to give information to people without it being in statute as well. Is that what you're saying?
Ms. Cotasoy.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, yes.
Mr. Chair, I see Senator people Higgins. Hovering, and I don't know if they want to comment on this section or article or not.
Do we have a gallery caucus? Is that what
Yeah, gallery caucus. Good word.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, Dave Renner representing the Minnesota Medical Association. And we have some major concerns with a vast part of Article 16. Let me state first that we are in favor of efforts to avoid fraud. We don't want to promote fraud. We want to try to eliminate as much fraud as possible. The first we've seen this language was last night as well. So Senator Hand has talked about some of this coming late. We would point out, starting on page 26, section 4 is the area that we've really focused on just in the last 24 hours, that much of the language in here is very vague and seems to be overly broad. It was talked about there is this, the authority for the commissioner to employ his temporary moratorium, a moratoria on new providers. If they happen to fall into a category of providers that may be at risk or a significant potential for fraud or abuse, without defining what that means. There's no definitions of what a category of provider is. Does that mean physicians? Does that mean a group within physicians? Does that mean hospitals? Does that mean clinics? It's unclear what that means. As I say, nowhere in the bill does it talk about, does it define what significant risk of fraudulent activity is. When you look through this, not only is there the authority for the commissioner to put a moratorium on new providers, if you look on paragraph C on lines 27.14, there's also then if the commissioner determines that a provider is in a category of providers for which there's a significant risk of fraud, they can withhold payments for up to 90 days. Again, that seems to be a little overly broad and vague to us. There's also language on lines 27.18 and 19, which talks about, again, a provider, the condition of enrollment. If a provider is within a particular industry sector, again, without definitions of what that means. There's further language that demands that the commissioner shall terminate a provider. If they have been terminated from Medicare, it's unclear if that's a physician who was with a clinic at one point and that clinic has been terminated. They've now gone to another clinic. Are they now required to be terminated? There's some vague language about having to report down on lines 27.30 and on. You have to disclose all previous affiliations that the provider may have had with other folks that may have had some bad debt. And then going on page 28, lines 11, again, as a condition of enrollment in the program, if the provider, if the provider is a part of a category of providers that the commissioner believes may be at risk of fraud, again, there's now requirements for criminal background checks, including fingerprinting. It's unclear who this provider is. Is this just the individual physician or other practitioner? Is this the clinic? Is it all hospital staff? Again, and then it also makes us nervous when we see civil penalties of up to $50,000. So our frustration is that we have not had a chance to have any conversations with the department other than about a 10-minute conversation in the hallway last night. We don't think this language is ready yet, and we would strongly encourage more work before this moves forward.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I would like to ask the department if they have had an opportunity to review this language with providers and get any feedback, and if this language reflects feedback that has been received from the providers.
Ms. Cortesai?
Mr. Chair and members, I will ask my colleague actually to come and speak to that exactly.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Mark Peroni. I'm with the Department of Human Services. Much of this language has been taken directly from federal regulations, new screening regulations that were issued in February. We have notified providers of the regulations and sent alerts to providers on February 2nd, February 16th, February 28th, March 14th, March 28th, April 4th, and April 11th. It did not include the exact language in the bill, but it alerted them to the changes in federal regulations.
State register.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, on that point, page 27, line 30, how would a provider know in their application that some previous affiliate of theirs, even an indirect previous affiliate, has an unpaid debt to the state or federal health care program? I mean, how would you know? I mean, people you were affiliated, you used to work with might have a debt. Is that the way the federal law words it right now?
Mr. Perron?
Mr. Chair, Senator, could you tell me where you're...
Mr. Perron, page 27, line 30. Providers submitting an application shall disclose any current or previous affiliation, direct or indirect, the provider or vendor that's in unpaid debt to any state or federal health care program.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the language describes an affiliation as having control or is controlled by or under common control. And typically, under federal regulation, control refers to an ownership interest or being a member of a board of directors. So we would assume they would know that there's an unpaid debt.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Perroni, you were a board member of your doctor at a clinic, and your affiliated doctors, because they're all in the same clinic under the same ownership or something, you're no longer there. You're on in some other clinic now, and you're submitting an application, and how would you know if one of your previous colleagues has a debt to the federal government?
Mr. Perroni.
Mr. Chair, Senator, you would know if your organization has a previous debt. If one of your fellow owners or fellow providers had a debt under another entity or another provider, that would not necessarily fall under this.
Senator Murray?
Mr. Chairman, but if, thinking of the clinic I go to, it has, I don't know, 10 doctors or so, if they are under, they're clearly affiliates under this, if under common control, because it's the same ownership of the whole clinic, and you leave there, you're no longer there, and some of the doctors in that previous clinic have a debt that came up in the last year or two and you've been gone for 5 years, how would you know? Because it does say previous. It doesn't say not just current, but it has to be previous as well.
Mr. Perroni?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't believe the intent is to penalize that doctor who would have not been there at the time there was a debt.
I mean, it says that, however, I think it does need cleaning up.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I would also like to get some clarification on Section J on page 28, or not, I don't know if it's section, paragraph J, talking about the commissioner may terminate the enrollment, exclude from participation any provider, vendor, individual making or causing to be made any false statement, et cetera. And then the commissioner may impose civil monetary penalties to not exceed $50,000. And my question is, I guess a couple of questions. First, is the phrase causing to be made, is that a term of art? Is that legally defined? What is exactly does that mean? Secondly, when it says the commissioner may impose, are there any conditions under which the commissioner may do that, or is it just sort of by the whim or discretion of the commissioner? And third, is there any way to appeal that if that penalty were to be made? Does anybody have a way to say, I don't think that's legitimate, and what is the process to do that?
We'll let counsel mull that a little bit. Before we go there, Senator Berglund, I think, had a question to the previous point.
Well, actually, it was a statement, and it had to do with the issue that Senator Marty was raising. And I'm sure that this language is in federal law because occasionally there might be a provider who has committed fraud or is in a partnership with someone and they committed fraud and they dissolve that organization and then they reapply to be a vendor under a different name or under their individual names. And I'm sure that that's why this language is here and what it's trying to get at. And so the kind of situation that Senator Marty is describing, I don't think is really what is covered here. I think it's more the kind of situation that I'm describing.
Mr. Renner?
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, I think you're right in the sense that there is an intent to try to get at those situations where shadow organizations are put up just to get around. Our concern, however, is that this language doesn't seem to be as precise and as narrow as it needs to be, and it does potentially raise some of the questions that Senator Marty was raising. Our request at this point is that this is not ready yet. I think we are happy to try to work with the department and see if we can narrow some of this, but we have real concerns if this goes forward in this form.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, perhaps the department could just help us understand how much of this is verbatim taken from the federal requirements and how much of it has been elaborated upon or enlarged upon by the department's own language. Because if it's in the federal law, you know, we're not going to fix it. I mean, we're not going to be able to fix it. So, you know, if there are some parts that we can fix, fine. But if it's in federal law, then we're not going to be able to fix it. We're going to have to fix it at the federal level or something.
Mr. Perron?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, much of this language was taken directly from federal regulations, and I can follow up and show you what that language is.
And Mr. Peroni, I think the concern would be more of, you said much of it is taken from the federal language. I think the concern would be about that which is not more than that which is.
Correct.
Mr. Renner, I have a question related to what Senator Marty was talking about. I forget the line, but there was if the department had reason to believe there was some ill intent or something, that the payments could be delayed. Do providers have various agreements or contractual obligations that would require them to maintain certain amount of reserves, 90 days of cash or something like that? And is that common or uncommon?
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe there's any state law that requires a minimum reserves, but good business practice, of course, would require that you have reserves. You also have obligations of paying payroll and paying your bills. So, I mean, there's always concerns with payments are delayed. What does that do to your cash flow?
Okay. I understand good business practice. I just wasn't sure if there was a standard agreement in the business operations where certain vendors or lien holders would require that level of capitation, and if something like this happened and threw you out of compliance, would cause all kinds of troubles. Senator Berglund, Senator Higgins?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm curious because I have I would have assumed that the department for way more years than any of us has been around has had the authority to deal with waste, fraud, and abuse, and already doing this kind of work. And I'm kind of surprised to see that, you know, here in 2011, we're coming up with something dealing with waste, fraud, and abuse. And I'm wondering how necessary this article really is. Don't we already have that authority?
Anybody? Mr. Peroni?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I suppose there are a lot of fraud prevention efforts that the department makes. Much of this is a requirement coming out of federal regulations that we have to do, we're required to do. And that's the motivation to put it into legislation, and as well as a motivation to prevent fraud and waste.
Mr.
Senator Chair? Hand first to that.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to know if the Mr. Perone could tell us which federal regulations he's referring to. Can you tell us the specific reference, which law or statute or regulation are we referring to? Is this recent federal regulation? Is this longstanding federal regulation? What is the regulation that we're complying with here?
Mr. Perone?
Mr. Chair, Representative, this is recent. This was based on regulations that were initially proposed in September of 2010, and final regulations were issued February 2011. I don't, off the top of my head, have the exact citations.
Good enough for you, Senator Hand, for now?
Mr. Chairman, no. But well, there's other questions.
Oh, well, Senator Berglund first had your hand up earlier. Higgins.
It's the Linda.
Got a brain cramp going here. I think I have a caffeine deficiency. My coffee's way over there.
Somebody could probably do something about moving your coffee over. I think what I wanted to ask was whether when we have federal regulations we must comply with, do we always have to put them into statute?
Anyone?
Mr. Lights? Anybody know?
Should we leave that hanging? Well, while that's being contemplated, Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, with those federal regulations, I understand we don't have a choice to comply with them, but in this, like, line 14 of page 27. If the commissioner determines significant risk of fraudulent activity, the commissioner may withhold payment. The federal regulation, if it gives the commissioner discretion to withhold payment, we may need to say that here, I presume, but I just wonder, that strikes me as something that probably wasn't in the federal regulations, or it would be saying shall withhold payment. But the other question is, and it's one Mr. Renner raised earlier, or maybe it was Senator Hand, about the appeal process. I remember a year or two ago, I think it was the ambulance industry or something, one of the providers was testifying that DHS was not paying claims from the time they received them and agreed that they were legitimate claims. They weren't paying them for 6 months after they had, everybody agreed they were claims they were going to have to pay. And I'm just wondering, at that time, the industry felt they had no way to sanction the department for just holding on to the money as long as they wished. And I'm wondering what kind of appeal is there, because as Mr. Renner pointed out, significant risk of activity, fraudulent activity among a category of providers. In other words, I'm in an industry, say the ambulance industry or the chiropractic industry or something, and there is a significant risk of fraudulent activity, which I'm assuming there is in some places. It means they can withhold 90 days for any provider in that field?
Ms. Cortesoy.
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, I would like to clarify on the amendment. Actually, there was an additional sentence added that does clarify the appeals process. It's not clear as it is in a separate entity, a separate sheet of paper. I'd also like to just mention that we're definitely open to working on this language, clarifying those sections which are directly coming from federal regulations and those sections which have just been encouraged, and would like to move forward with the intention to remove those sections that people are not comfortable with.
Ms. Cortesoy, on the amendment, could you refer us to which line that might be?
It was page 28. It was 1.22 on the amendment.
You're saying 1.23?
1.2. I might have a different amendment.
1.23 through 1.25 is what I'm being told. So roster for those. And Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Kojisoy, I appreciate seeing that. Thanks for pointing that out. And I would strongly encourage the department to keep working on this language because I just think that it's way too broad. And the problem is very serious. I don't want to downplay that at all. I'm just saying that I think this language, you may do nothing wrong, but because you're in a certain category, you're going to be punished. And that appeal process, I mean, it doesn't say who has delayed payments isn't covered under that, but I think there are lots of things in here that need a lot of work.
Senator Lori.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess just on that same paragraph C, page 27, lines 14 through 17, I'm not sure. Maybe the department can clarify, but I don't think it is for any provider within that category. I think it's just for brand new ones, and it limits it only to the first 90 days of their existence in that. And so I'm just asking for clarification if I'm reading that wrong or what the intent is. Is it for any provider within that category, or is it for newly enrolled providers for 90 days? Because those are different things. And there seems to be some
Mr.
confusion.
Chair, Senator Lori, it's for those newly enrolled providers. And this is a section we are willing to work with folks to clarify as well.
Mr. Renner?
Mr. Chair, that's interesting to hear because I don't read it that way.
Good. That's,
I read the first paragraphs A and B talking about newly enrolled. I read paragraph C as any provider who happens to be in a category of providers for which the commissioner determines there has been a significant risk of fraudulent activity. So, again, I think part of the definition problems here is that there are a lot of undefined terms, and I think, again, this language just seems to be overly broad and not well thought through.
Any other questions or comments on this?
Yeah.
Senator Hand? Senator Lori?
Well, that same paragraph in C, and I'm glad to hear that because there did seem to be a good deal of confusion about that, and I am glad to hear that that was the intent. But at the end of that sentence, beginning paragraph C, is upon initial enrollment for a 90-day period. So I can, you know, I saw the beginnings of the intent there, but glad to get the clarification.
Senator Hand?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I share some of Mr. Renner's concern about the vague language and the. I am concerned, again, going back to my question I asked earlier about making or causing to be made. I think it's possible to make a misstatement of fact without intentionally making it, but this language seems to just say if you make a mistake, you could be fined $50,000. I'm not sure if that's what the federal regulation says, then I would say we shouldn't adopt it anyway, no matter what. But I am curious about the federal regulation, and I am curious to know, too, if these regulations or rules are written as a part of the recently adopted Federal Health Care Reform Act, and could the department answer that?
Ms. Cortese?
Mr. Chair, members, yes, the majority of these are out of the PPACA.
And Mr. Chairman and members, and with respect to Mr. Renner's concerns about this and I think other members' concerns, I would like to move to strike this section and perhaps it can be continued to work on, but I would move to strike Article 16 deleted from the bill.
So Senator Han has moved to strike all of Article 16. Is there discussion, questions from the members? Is there anyone at the table or in the audience that would like to speak to that?
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
You know, federal law does supersede state law. The advantage of having things also in state law is, you know, if a clinic or a provider has an attorney that they're asking for advice from, having it in the Minnesota statutes makes it a lot easier for that organization to receive proper information from an attorney. And you know, the department is still going to have to implement these things. If it's possible to make it clearer, then going forward, the department should work with the author to do that. But to take it out of the bill, I think, is doing everyone a disservice because much less likely we're going to work on making it better, and it's still going to get implemented.
I see Mr. Lights at the table.
Mr. Chair and members, Scott Lights with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Mr. Chair, I think the department would like to indicate, I think, a willingness to work on those sections of the bill, of this section, that are not verbatim from the federal law. The adoption of this language from that's part of the federal law into the state law, I think, as Senator Berglund has indicated, provides some ability to be clarify that the state and federal laws work together in that sense. Secondly, oftentimes there are when laws are passed such as this at the federal level, our participation in the Medicaid program and ability to receive matching funds frequently is tied to some of those pieces of that. We are certainly open to working on those sections which are encouraged to make clarifying language where we can. It would be our preference to leave the language in the bill at this time if we could, so that we can continue to work on that language and clarify it up in a manner that will be understood by providers and give them comfort that where we can get rid of vagueness, we will be certainly be willing to do that. But it would be the department's preference this time to leave it in the bill moving forward and work on that clarification.
Thank you, Mr. Light. Senator Hand?
Mr. Chairman, I would just renew my motion, and this bill will be conferenced, and if there is an opportunity to work on language by the time we do that, I think there will be opportunity to address some of the concerns. So I'd like to renew the motion.
Okay. Unless we have further question or comment, then Senator Hand has moved to strike Article 16 from the bill as amended. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. We now have the bill before us again as amended, and we'll be moving on to Article 17. Ms. Cortesoli.
Mr. Chair, members, Article 17 implements a recommendation by the Office of Legislative Auditors in their March 2011 report to create a non-emergency medical transportation advisory committee.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, my recollection is that there is a separate bill traveling through the process that's been passed out of this committee, and I am not sure how this language might be in conflict with that bill. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think it's a good idea to have two things traveling along that are doing the same thing, because chances are somebody will put something in one of them that isn't in the other one, even if they start out the same. So I'm just wondering if we need this in here, because we do have that other bill. I don't know where it is at. I don't know. I think Senator Newman was the author of it. I don't know if it's met deadline. If we could get some of that information so we would know whether we should have this in this bill or not, I'd appreciate it.
Hi.
The committee, please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tara Erickson, representing the R80 Medical Transportation Coalition. Senator Berglund is right. This language is already to establish the work group is actually in both of the HHS finance omnibus bills at this time. They are almost nearly identical. Most of the providers are requesting the House language. There was one little mix-up of an amendment that didn't make it onto the Senate. And after the Office of the Legislative Auditor report came out, most providers and stakeholders were nervous about the work group being set up and actually wanted to be named as to what groups were going to be in here. And so this obviously goes in conflict of what is out there right now.
Senator Berglund.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it doesn't give me great comfort to know that something is in the omnibus bill, especially if it is a provision that is a non-money item, because the governor has said he wants the non-money items out of those bills. And so, you know, I guess I'm not sure what we should do here, but certainly we ought to make sure we've got the correct version in this bill.
Senator Hand.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Berglund, I appreciate your concern about the omnibus bill. We're going to continue to work on that. But for purposes of this bill, and as I said, it is going to go to a conference with the House version of the bill. And what we could do is prepare an amendment reflecting that language and insert it into this bill that would be identical to the language you're referring to, if that would be acceptable. Or we could strike this provision right now and then address it there as a so.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I guess my preference would be that we make sure the language is identical and then be cognizant of the fact that, that we have this in two different places so that it stays identical.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, maybe it would be good then to strike this this article of the bill so that when we get to conference we'll see the void and be prompted to bring in the other language that we have already in place.
You could do that, Senator Hahn, or you might want to keep the language as a placeholder. Senator Berglund?
Mr. Chairman, when things get taken out of a bill, it doesn't mean that people notice in a conference committee that something needs to be done about it. It might not be in either bill that go to conference committee, in which case it would be a violation of the rules to put something in the bill. So my suggestion is that you leave it in, Mr. Chairman, Senator Hahn, and then if it is not identical to what we've already passed, prepare an amendment for the floor that would make it identical.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Berglund, that's fine. I, and perhaps Senator Fischbach can comment, but my understanding of the rules is anything that is germane to the bill itself can be brought into a conference committee, if that's correct. And I don't know if Senator Fischbach wants to comment. But I think either case, we could do it. But we can leave it in. I'm not trying to push to take it out. But.
Senator Hahn, she actually has Masons and rules right in front of her. Senator Fischbach.
It's just that sad, Mr. Chairman.
What do you have at your fingertips?
Well, you know what? Give me a minute, and I will find it.
Well, Senator Lurie had a question, so maybe we'll go to him while you're perusing there.
Well, I was, you know, I didn't know if how much this would weigh in, but I think that if this stays in the bill, which I don't know, either way is okay by me, but I think this would bring it to state government, creation of a task force.
And, Mr. Chairman, I wondered about that as well. And
well, Senator Hahn, Senator Lurie, I'm reading through here. It's an advisory committee. I don't know if that's semantics or not. Maybe counsel could give us some insight on that. That's your insight. There we go. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, it didn't bring the omnibus bill to state government. So,
That's true.
So we have precedents.
I'm just kind of worried that somehow this might not end up happening. And I think really everybody on this committee and the legislative auditor felt that it should happen. So.
And Mr. Chairman, I don't think I made a motion. I'm not going to make a motion to remove this language. I think we have some assurance from our witness here that we will have an amendment drafted to bring in the language that this committee has already adopted. So if we can let it go at that, we'll just leave it alone for now. At least that'd be my preference.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Anyone in the audience that wants to speak to Article 17? I don't see any, so then we can proceed. Ms. Cordesa.
Mr. Chair, members, Article 18, Managed Care Reporting. This proposal requires DHS to develop a consistent standard for the collection of detailed financial provider payment and other data for managed care organizations.
Okay. Any questions? Please state your name for the record.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Barsh. I represent Medica. The language in Article 18, I think, is reflective of the executive order that Governor Dayton issued on March 23rd. For the record, I just want to state you don't have concerns with the executive order or the governor or this body's desire to have more information available about managed care organizations and their administration of state public programs. I do want to highlight a couple concerns with the language as it's before us, and we had a brief discussion with the department about this last night as it was being heard in the House. In particularly areas where the data that's going to be collected from the Department of Human Services about our administration of state public programs actually reaches into data about our commercial business. Specifically, if you look on lines 34.6 and 34.7, This references language about the encounter data that is collected by all payers in the state across all lines of business. And currently that data is sent to a vendor the state has, and its specific use is to develop the provider peer grouping methodology and report that's expected sometime later this month. What the language is in the bill to do is give access to the Department of Human Services to all of that encounter data, including data that would be on the Medicaid program, but also commercial data. The Department of Human Services already collects the encounter data from the health plans for the Medicaid population. That's in the current contract, and as of April 1st this year, the Department of Human Services is collecting encounter data on our Medicaid enrollees. And encounter data is basically all the information that goes along with the claim. So it's the provider, the type of service, the specific payment to the provider, any third-party liability, et cetera. It's a very detailed list of information that goes along with it. So the department is getting that encounter data for the state public program enrollees. What we have a concern about is them collecting that data from the commercial population as well. And we believe that these two lines would give them that authority, which we don't believe is necessary for the administration or the oversight of our administration of state public programs. The other concern we may have is, or that we do have, is going back to page 33. Again, when we look at, let me get my reference right, excuse me. Starting on lines 33.29, clearly it's important for the administration and the department to have information on the payment rates that we're delivering to providers. However, when we get into placing that type of data request in statute, we get concerns about moving away from a conversation about specific payment methodologies to prescriptive ways of collecting it. And this is a concern particularly when they talk about total cost of care or risk-sharing arrangements. We understand the department is moving forward, and we're partnering with them on applying those types of payment methodologies to our Medicaid program. But when we use total cost of care payment arrangements or risk-sharing arrangements, those apply across both the public programs and the commercial business. In other words, we don't work with the provider to set up a total cost of care arrangement just for the Medicaid program. We apply that methodology to both Medicaid and commercial. And we have a concern about sort of releasing the methodology of the how we're reimbursing for the commercial population, also at a time when the department is issuing an RFI to do this type of work themselves. Clearly, as I mentioned, we want to work with the department as they develop their RFI on ACO models of direct contracting. We've already had conversations with them, and we and I know others have submitted a response to the RFI. We just get a little nervous about putting some of the specifics in statute, as opposed to continuing the conversation, which would still be allowed under the genesis or the opening paragraph of this article.
Thank you, Ms. Barch. Are there any questions, or Senator Higgins?
Mr. Chair, I'm confused. I see we are repealing a section and adding a section, and I'm wondering, are we repealing other financial reporting requirements and putting these in their place? Are these in addition to other ones that are already in statute? Are these more or less than what we currently have?
Well, Senator Higgins, my understanding is that they're repealing some reporting requirements and putting new ones in place, but maybe Mr. Leitz could shine some light on that for you.
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, Mr. Chair, you're largely correct. The repealer, which is subdivision 9B, much of the data that is talked about under section B of this language is already was previously collected under 9B. There is some additional information that's being collected under what's now 9C under that B section there. So in essence, the data that was previously collected is being replaced by this data collection, and this data collection is somewhat more robust in its data gathering.
Any other questions? If someone wants to speak.
And Mr. Chair, while Ms. Krinke's coming up, just a technical question. If we're repealing 9B, doesn't this new section become 9B?
Mr. Leitz?
Instead of 9C?
Mr. Chair, I would defer to counsel on the drafting rules.
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins know you're going to see in the statute that 9B has been repealed.
Is that what it says? Okay.
So you have the history.
Thanks.
Ms. Krinke.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. I happened to bring with me today the section of law that's being repealed.
You need to stay at the microphone so we can record it.
For the record, Mr. Chair, I don't know that the Hospital Association necessarily has a preference between what is being proposed in this law and the repealer, but I think for the record, we would like to just make sure one of them stays in place. So we had heard, of course, Capitol gossip that there might be an effort to delete the new underlying language but keep the repealer in the bill. So for the record, the Hospital Association wants to make sure that we have one set of this transparency language that moves forward. So if we're going to, if there's an effort to amend the new transparency language, then the repealer would need to come out. I do want to point out one distinction. In the last sentence of the current law that is being repealed, it says that this information will be made available to the public on a website to providers as well as to other health plans, and we think it's very important to have it clarified that this information be made public. So under the new language that is being proposed, there is no requirement that this data that is being collected be made publicly available. So I just wanted to point out that distinction between what is in current law versus what is being proposed as new law.
Mr. Leitz.
Mr. Chair, and to Ms. Krinke's point, first of all, we don't at all disagree that the information should be made public in a form that doesn't violate any of the non-private nature of it. This was intended to go along with a provision of the governor's executive order, which was to produce an annual report to the legislature and to the public on our managed care contracting. So we certainly saw that as being a way to make sure that information is public, but we wouldn't also disagree on Ms. Krinke's point.
Questions or comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there anyone else that would like to speak to this section here? No, I don't see anyone coming to the table. Senator Higgins, you have a question
Mr.
or comment?
Mr. Chair, if everybody agrees that the language should be public, should we not add the last sentence of the repealed language into the new language? The sentence that says the commissioner shall make this available on the website and that kind of thing? Wouldn't it make sense if we want it to be public, we say so?
Well, that's not a motion. Is that a question from someone in particular?
I'm just trying to figure out how much of that last paragraph should go in there.
Senator Hand, were you wanting to say something?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Higgins, I do have an amendment pertaining to this section. And it is trying to address some of the concerns that were being raised. And it is some, maybe it would be an appropriate time to talk about that.
Are you wanting to offer that amendment now, Senator Hand?
I don't know, I think.
It's the A2 amendment, I think, if we've got.
We do have copies up here. Would you like to offer that?
Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members, I'd like to offer the A2 amendment. And
Senator Hand offers the A2 amendment, and that's being handed out now. Whenever you're ready, Senator Hand, you can speak to that.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, this was an amendment suggestion that was brought to me based on some of the concerns, and I'm looking at it, and to the question that was just raised by Ms. Krinke, we probably should have, in addition, a deletion of the repealer as well, which is on.
The repealer is deleted.
Pardon me. This does it?
You've repealed. This amendment would repeal the entire section, or delete the entire section, which includes the.
I'm sorry. I misread it. So it deletes the repealer and the new language and replaces it with this language so that the current As I understand it, the current reporting would stay in effect in addition to this, what is called subdivision 9C. This also goes back and addresses concerns in the previous section of the bill, Article 9, and I believe there are some people who would like to make a comment about that as well.
Mr. Barch is at the table. Are you wanting to speak?
Mr. Chairman, I can address the issues of the amendment that deal with Article 18, but not Article 9. Very quickly, what the changes to Article 18 would do is basically pick up the language of the governor's executive order as it applies to the increased reporting requirements or the development of a new standardized format for collecting that information. And then, as Senator Hahn indicated, removes the repealer from the bill, which means that the existing language regarding reimbursement information would continue to be collected as well.
Mr. Barch, I was trying to read and listen at the same time. Did you have a position pro or con on this?
We support the amendment.
Okay. Is Senator Berglund?
Can someone tell me if this comprehensive report that has to be done annually will have a cost to it, and you know, for adding a spending item to a policy bill here?
Senator Hahn or Mr. Lights?
Mr. Chair, this, I believe what this amendment is trying to capture is what is in the executive order, which was to have an annual report on this. So to that extent, I understand the question, but I think we would largely do some of this within the governance of the governor's executive order. The question I think I would have on this would be related to one of the things that I think the language as drafted in the bill allows for is the collection of more detailed information on administrative costs across product lines that we don't currently collect under the existing language, and I don't believe we have the authority to collect under the existing state statute. So I think that would be one issue that we would want to continue to work on were this amendment to go on, to enable us to be able to do that, to be able to produce that. And then I think while understanding some of the things that Mr. Barsh was saying about the rate methodologies, we do think that some of that might be important to have from a public transparency perspective in an aggregate manner. And so I think if this were to move forward, I think would wish to continue to work with the plans on that piece of it as well.
Mr. Chairman, we're happy to continue to work with the department on those two pieces.
Okay. So is there – excuse me, Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, so we have the old language, we have the proposed language in the bill, and then we've got the amended, the A2 language. And I guess my question – to Commissioner Lights is, which is the most robust reporting of the three? Which can we get the best data about what's going on in this industry?
Mr. Lights?
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, we brought forth this article because we felt that we needed to add some additional robustness to the data that is currently where we have current statutory authority for. So from our perspective, the language in the bill provides us the ability to collect more detailed and more robust information than we currently are able to.
And Mr. Chair, and more data than the A2 amendment would allow you to collect?
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, yes, the A2 amendment essentially would have us back to our current existing statutory authority, which the article here would replace it in a more robust manner.
Thank Senator
you.
Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Lights, the article, as you've amended it here, does it create more work for the people submitting the reports? Does it create more work for the department? We talk about costs of everything. And we have to be careful that when we're passing requests for new reports, we are putting a burden on someone.
And so could you please address any consideration that you gave to that as you developed this? Did you streamline? Did you make it easier? Did you access reports that they already do for other purposes? Thank you.
Mr. Lightson, before you answer that, for my clarification, Senator Benson, are you asking about the language in the A2 or the language in the bill as before us?
The department language in the bill as before us.
Okay, thank you. I wasn't clear. So, Mr. Lightson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, a couple of things on your question. The first is that the reporting that we'll be doing under the governor's executive order or under the language that is here would be building on what's currently being submitted by the health plans. What our amendment, what our article language does is does add some additional authority to collect some additional information. That information is, I would say, additive to what we're having. So there would be some marginal additional administrative costs, but I want to also point out that that is data that on the administrative cost side where the plans are submitting it now in the aggregate. What we would be doing is merely having them break that out by product line, which would be and we won't deny there was some additional marginal cost to that, but we don't believe it to be a large marginal cost.
Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, I hate to use the word fiscal note, but do you think the plans could develop a fiscal note for your amendment? I mean, I'm not trying to be smart alecky. It's pretty tough for us to sit here and ask for things from the department and get whacked with fiscal note every time we do it, and then the department asks for marginal additional information. I think we just need to be careful about what we're doing when we send information, when we send requests for information outside of this body. And if we need this, I do have concern about the private, commercial side of this being accessed, and have concerns about what's going to be done there. And I just would ask that the department and the commissioner and the governor be respectful of additional work that we give to people who work with the government.
Senator Berglin.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Barsh, don't you think it'd be better to try to fix up the language in the original bill to make it clear that the department isn't going to be collecting proprietary commercial information rather than, you know, doing this amendment and not being able to collect certain information that would be needed?
Mr. Lights? Was that to Mr. Barch?
Mr. Chairman, I think that was to me. Mr. Chairman and Senator Berglin, the intent of the A2 amendment wasn't to remove the ability that the department was seeking in collecting additional information, particularly about the administrative expenses of administering these programs across segment line. It was clearly to pick up the language that was in the executive order as it was issued by the governor, and to remove some of those issues concerns I raised earlier about the proprietary information. Again, we're happy to work with the department if it's easier to just delete a few lines of the existing bill and move forward. I mean, we can do that as well.
Well,
Senator
Mr.
Berglin?
Chairman, I'm asking that question because I'd feel more comfortable if that's what we did. Mr. Barsh, do you have language to suggest that would clarify the existing bill in regard to the release of commercial information?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Berglin, I guess I would suggest removing lines 34.6, 34.7, as well as on line 33.29, everything after the second comma, and then lines 33.3 and 33.30 to 33.33. Again, all of the reimbursement methodologies that reach across both public programs and commercial are issues we're trying to work with the department on in order to help them and all of us actually create a new reimbursement methodology for the Medicaid program. The concern is having that language and statute and the ability to collect it.
We have the A2 amendment before
and
us.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, one other thing. If we did do that, we would still need to remove the repealer in Section 3 as well.
Krinke, are you wanting to make a comment?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, while the bill may be only 24 hours old, this is 5 minutes old for the provider community. I have some concerns about commenting on this amendment on the fly. It appears to me to not require the information to be specific. It can be done in aggregate. And I'm concerned that we need by provider, by payer, by plan, and that moving to just aggregate reporting does not serve the transparency issue as well. That's just my comment on the fly. I haven't had an opportunity to look at this more thoroughly. So I think we are more comfortable with the department's original language in the bill than we are moving this amendment today. So,
Mr. Bartsch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one quick response. The comments I made in my introductory remarks are that the department currently collects specific encounter data information for the Medicaid program. So they have the information for every claim that's filed, the provider type, the specific payment, any third-party payment liability, all of that information that Ms. Krinke just referenced in terms of reporting on specific plan, by provider is currently being collected by the department.
Again, we have the A2 amendment before us. Senator Hand.
Mr. Chairman and members, I would like to invite Mr. Griffin, I think, wants to come up and comment on the other part of the amendment with respect to Article 9.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. For the record, my name is Phil Griffin. I'm representing Life Science Alley, a trade association of 600 companies in the medical device, biologics, and diagnostics area in Minnesota. And I wanted to speak briefly to Article 9 and ask that the committee consider the deletion of this article. We don't see the need for the broad language that is in this, and I'll just point to parens 1 and read to you that a health service or item that is not a drug, and we're not certain why we're treating devices differently than drugs, is considered investigative, if it meets any of the criteria, and there's a whole list of them. But the first one to me seems extremely broad, which is the effectiveness of a health service or an item in treatment of the recipient's medical condition, and it's not supported by the available evidence. And we would point to discussions that this committee has had in years past about how we put together the decisions on what covered services are and what they are not, and the difficulty that there is in making those determinations. We spend a lot of time in the world of the FDA trying to make determinations on whether devices are approved or not, and then there are all kinds of systems that are in place within the payer community to try and make determinations on what is covered. But we don't think that doing it in this manner is the best and most effective way of doing it. We have a number of concerns, and I'd be happy to go into those, but to be brief, our request would simply be the deletion of this article. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, if there are questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Again, members, we have the A2 amendment before us. Are there any questions from the members at the table? Is there anyone else that would like to speak to the A2 amendment? All right. Well, Senator Hand has moved the A2 amendment. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 The opposed?
No.
The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. Again, we have the bill as amended before us. Senator Hand?
Mr. Chairman, and thank you. And I appreciate the committee's patience with this and also the testifiers. And I think just generally, we had a bill on the committee yesterday evening that had some similar concerns about it. I think that the lateness of these bills being brought to the public and just the inability for people to have an opportunity to sort through them and raise questions and find ways to make compromise. I think all the things that we've talked about, there are ways to work these out. I believe this bill will end up in a conference committee, and we will certainly try to do that. But I guess I think I'm a little bit personally frustrated by the relatively short opportunity that we've had to have this bill in front of the public. And so I guess at this point I would just like to move that the bill, Senate File 1284, be recommended, passed, and sent to the floor.
All Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, I share some of Senator Hand's concerns about the time and so on this. And on the discussion on the last article of the bill, I think that's and I think we should do more than that. And I have an A3 amendment I'd like to offer, and I'd like to make a couple of changes incorporated in them into it. I'll wait till it's handed out. But bottom line is we've had these contracts for 20-some years now, and we really don't have a lot of, we've never audited them. I know the chair's been working on some of this. I and a lot of others have too. And this would be sort of a turbo audit of the contracts after all these years. It would provide as confidential data to the department. Much of this they're already receiving, but this would also require the Department of Health or designee to designate somebody to put it together, the payment data and so on, so we can have a true audit of what is happening in here. I'd like to incorporate three changes into it. One would be to delete line 1.2. That's already been done in the Hann Amendment. And then on page 2, line 5, to spell HIPAA correctly. It's a typo there. And then on page 3, strike the $30 million and put $3 million in. And line 14, designate a portion of, afterward, the word designate on line 14, add a portion of. And Mr. Chairman, with that, I'd like to move the amendment and be happy to discuss it more. The bottom line is.
Before that, Senator Marty, we'll just. Senator Marty moves the A3 amendment to
those
that motion,
changes.
Senator Marty. With those changes incorporated.
And Mr. Senator Chairman, Martin. Thank you. Again, these are huge contracts. There are $6 billion in biennium from the state money plus an equal amount of federal money. And after 20 years, we've never really audited them. And this would be, in effect, the money would be for the state's getting a lot of the data already, the encounter data. This would allow them to match that with the payment data, and the purposes are very clear. I mean, on page 2 of it, we want to make sure we're using this to track down to make sure that we're using the money effectively. At the bottom of page 1, it must identify possible underutilization, denials of claim, inappropriate service utilization, administrative costs, insight into patient treatment outcomes, speed of claims payment. And this $3 million, which they acknowledge is a overly generous estimate for what it might cost for a couple years to do this, but that's 1/20 of 1% of what we're spending on it in state funds. And we've been doing this for 20 years, and I think it's far and away the biggest state contracts we have, and they've never been audited. So I wanted to move the amendment.
And Senator Marty, there's an appropriation which would make this a budget bill.
Mr. Chairman, and I am proposing where the money might come from, but I wanted to have this up for discussion for a minute anyway.
Senator Hann.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Marty, I appreciate your bringing the amendment. I'm not had a chance to look at this prior to just now. I guess my thought at this point would be to not accept the amendment, and I'm not so much concerned about $3 million. I think we could probably work if that's trying to find a way to do that or perhaps bring it into the budget conference committee if we needed to do that. But I think that this might be worth talking about a little bit more, and I'm not sure yet if we've had an opportunity for everybody else who might be concerned with this to have an opportunity to look at it as well. So I guess at this point I would just say let's not adopt it, but I'd be happy to have this further considered, and as we go forward into the conference committee, perhaps there's something that we could do to at least take a look at it.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Marty, where did you come up with the $3 million figure? I mean, obviously, if we're going to do this, we want to spend enough money to do it right. But on the other hand, you know, when we're in the fiscal situation we're in, we don't want to have people bidding for the amount we have if that's not what it would cost to do it.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, that's a good point, and the $3 million is a generous amount. Obviously, obviously, as you point out, when they're contracting with somebody for it, that if they know there's $3 million available, they may aim for that, and the intent of that is not to do that. Point is, and again, I'm glad you point out the fact that it's worth doing it right when you do it. The $3 million, it's just, again, it's a large amount of money, but we're talking phenomenal amounts of money. Again, that's 1/20 of 1% we're spending on these contracts. In what you're saying and what Senator Hand's saying is exactly right. I mean, this is not the kind of thing that we can absorb real quickly now. I think it's very important that we recognize we have not done this auditing appropriately. It's incredibly large sum of money year after year without the audits, without the checking up, without the are we getting our money's worth. And so with that, I did want to put the amendment out there. I appreciate your comment, Senator Hand, about how this deserves further discussion and further outlook. And again, as I said, the $3 million is I think more generous than it would need to be, but I wanted to make sure we were to cover it enough so we would do it appropriately. But with that, I am going to withdraw the amendment. I just want to put it out there because I think we have to.
Senator Marty withdraws the A3 amendment. Senator Berglund?
Well, Mr. Chairman, in case this is going to appear again someplace, I'm going to ask the question now more directly so maybe I can get an answer next time I ask it. Why not $2 million? Why not $1.5 million?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Murray.
Senator Berglund, that's why I put the amendment out there and said I was going to withdraw it, because I do not have a precise amount for it, and I don't want to be suggesting we appropriate $3 million without knowing what the cost of it should be. What I'm saying is, and again, with a lot of contracts, you don't know what the cost of it's going to be, but we can do more precise than this. I wanted to put it out here for discussion purposes and just to give people an indication that the number that came in the bill draft was not meant to be, it's nowhere near that kind of ballpark number. I put it out there just to present the concept and a ballpark for what kind of amount of money it might require to do this right.
All right. Well, Senator Hand has moved the Senate File 1284 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just want to thank Senator Marty for your willingness to withdraw the motion. But I appreciate your bringing it forward. And I do believe, as many believe, that this is a topic that we need to bring some scrutiny to. I think all of us understand we are spending a lot of money. We want to make sure that that money is being spent effectively, that we are getting what we are paying for as a public. I think there is a need to try to figure out how we can get transparency, and we've talked a lot, and there's been a lot of discussion about competitiveness and transparency and accountability. This may be a helpful part of that discussion, so I don't want to just say we are not interested in this at all, but I would like to at least move this forward as the bill as it is, and we can continue to work on this. But I appreciate your bringing the amendment forward. But yes, Mr. Chairman, I would renew my motion.
All right. On that motion, not seeing any more discussion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any of those opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is amended. Is passed. Sent to the floor. Thank you, Senator Hand. All right, members, we will be back at 9 a.m. in room 107.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee.
Committee is adjourned.